learning isn't a competitive sport.
Right.
You know, it's not a zero-sum game. You can learn, I can learn, we can share the learning. I mean, that's the whole notion of it.
And welcome back to the Modern Learners Podcast, episode number 26. I am Will Richardson. And that voice you heard just a second ago was my good friend and colleague, Bruce Dixon, down in Australia, who was reminding us once again that learning is not a competitive sport, despite the fact that in schools, we seem to make it one with all the tests and grades and assessments and standardized assessments that we give kids to rank and sort them. We have an interesting conversation for you tonight about assessments based on a post that Bruce actually wrote a few weeks ago that got some pretty interesting buzz on the internet. So we thought we'd expand on that a little bit, talk a little bit about what the implications of standardization are in terms of assessments, but also talk about what we could be doing instead that would be more beneficial to kids and would serve our kids in much healthier ways than what the current system does. Really want to thank you for dropping by to listen to this episode, and would encourage you, if you like what you hear, to go to iTunes and give us a rating, give us some feedback. Don't forget, you can also find Bruce and me online at change.school. Our fourth cohort of Change School is going to be opening up in January, and we'd love to have you join us for that. And also, don't forget our new community at changeleaders.community. That's the web address where we have over 300 people from around the world who are already engaging in conversations like around assessment and other school-related things at a pretty high level, trying to build the capacity of lots of people to engage in these really difficult yet important conversations around changing school at a higher level. So thanks again for listening. Enjoy this conversation between Bruce and me, and we will be back again next week with another edition of the podcast. Well, look at that, Bruce. We were only a minute late. That is really good for us. I'll tell you, usually we're at least 5-7 minutes late, but 6:16, not bad. How are you?
I'm really good, mate. It's been a while since we've been able to get together and do this podcast.
It has been a while. Life keeps getting in the way. And, you know, I guess that's a good thing, I guess, as long as it's on a positive note. I've been moving, finally got moved into my new digs, which there aren't any lights on, and
yeah, we can see
the people on
backdrop.
The podcast won't be able to see anything anyway, but we're on Facebook Live right now, and welcome to all of you who are kind of joining us live and who are watching the delayed or the video later down the road somewhere. We appreciate you coming in and listening and watching. But so Bruce, and you've been hosting weddings, and you're going to New Zealand tomorrow, and it's just
goodness
crazy.
Me. Just a busy life. I mean, you've been in the middle of hurricanes down in Puerto Rico, wow. And that's all fixed up, isn't it, down in Puerto Rico
yeah.
now? Your president's
oh, yeah, it's all good to go.
It. Yep,
all
fantastic.
Good to go.
That was a quick recovery down there.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've actually been up into our cyclone, well, we call them cyclones, our cyclone capital, Mackay, which is northern Queensland, as you said, hosting a wedding, and off to New Zealand. So, yeah, we move around in between podcasts.
Yes, it seems that way.
You physically well, with the family, though. But anyway, but I've still got my green screen with my books behind me. Everyone
that's
tells
very
me
good.
Must be
I need to put up a green screen with something else behind me, but a empty bookshelf. it's kind of the contrast is kind of interesting right now, at least anyway. Right? But we are committed to doing more of these podcasts on a regular basis. We scoped that the next couple of months, and we're probably going to try to do these every other week. And then actually, I've got a couple people lined up for, I think, some interesting conversations in the next few days, which we'll be rolling out. So hopefully we can expect these to come a little bit more regularly, which will be a good thing. But so tonight, you know, in the midst of all this, moving around and weddings and whatever else, you wrote a pretty interesting blog post on the Modern Learner site that got a little bit of traffic, I think over 500 shares or something on Facebook, which for us is a lot. And it was on assessment. Mm. And so I thought it might be interesting tonight if we kind of riffed a little bit on that and just asked you to kind of give us some of the highlights on what you wrote, and then let's talk about some of the reaction and some of the other things that we've been talking about, both just the two of us and also in Change School and in our new Change Leaders community, by the way. So so why don't you give us the overview? What was it that you think provoked people's thinking so much about your little riff on assessment?
I don't think it was necessarily anything that I'd written. I think what I did was probably write what a lot of people were thinking. And it's, you know, that's often the way when people get traction with an idea. It's hey, this guy's just saying the stuff I've been thinking. And it's just, I mean, I think it struck all of us, you know, just what a burden, what an impost this whole notion of testing now is within schools. And I, ironically, before I came up with the headline of the testing emperor finally has no clothes, you know, I was just going to use the word absurdity, because I actually think where we are with standardized high stakes testing at the moment is an absurdity. Here we have a situation where there was, I'll say little or no, and I'll always try and be a little bit conservative, little or no evidence of any benefit that could be derived from this notion of standardized testing. But with little or no evidence, it was introduced universally across most countries. I mean, you know, a lot of the focus has obviously been on the US. That's where a lot of it started under No Child Left Behind and other regimes. Just as bad down here in Australia with NAPLAN, through England, through everywhere. And very quickly it exploded, really, is the only word for it. And again, with little or no evidence of benefit. So wherever you read someone, you know, lauding the positives of it, there was no real educational framework for that discussion. It was sort of one of these populist ideals, you know, your general current affairs programs or your popular media will grab onto something like this. And probably the best example of just how unfounded this work was when it immediately went from this notion of standardized testings to publicizing the league tables of how everyone performed. So it's sort of, you'd almost think, couldn't we have just drawn breath for a second there and said, you know, like we're doing this standardized testing thing and it's having certain, you know, impact or repercussions. Do you think we could just draw breath for a second and, you know, ask ourselves, should we actually be publicizing this like we publicize football scores or basketball scores, you know? Because there are some people who, you know, people are in various positions on this notion of testing, standardized testing, and some people say, well, I don't mind it. The thing I hate is that there's the publicity that's given to the performance. And, you know, I know you've got it now in the States. We certainly in Melbourne, we had this on one of the Zoom discussions we had in Change School where, you know, we now have parents who are buying property houses for themselves based on league table test scores. This is an absurdity, absolutely absurdity.
And I think the biggest irony to me is that really it doesn't measure learning.
It
gives data, it gives a data point to what kids know at a particular moment. And again, it just goes back to common sense. Everybody knows that. No one will argue with it. You know, I mean, nobody goes, oh, yes, it does. It reflects deeply how kids learn. I mean, nobody argues that. No. But it's the one metric, it's the one measurement that we can assign to what we think kids are accomplishing in school, which is really all about what do they remember, what do they know, what are the kind of discrete, very narrow skills that maybe they can employ at any given time.
Yep.
And then, you know, what is the grade or number that we can assign to that? And, I mean, look, there are legitimate concerns that people have or reasons that people have to continue the argument for standardized tests, especially in a world where colleges rank and sort kids based on those tests. And if that's the goal that you want, you know, is to get into school, and in Australia, it's even worse, right? Because you have to get a number in order to pursue a particular profession, you know. So, I mean, I get it, but on their face, there isn't a real argument that those types of tests adequately or effectively measure learning in the ways that we talk about it, right? In the ways that are much more kind of meta and much more about application and doing and problem solving and all that type of stuff. So yeah, that's the biggest issue, I think.
Yeah, no, you know, one of the phrases I put in there, which is, you know, being used in many places, learning isn't a competitive sport.
Right.
You know, it's not a zero-sum game. You can learn, I can learn, we can share the learning. I mean, that's the whole notion of it. And there's so many poor assumptions, wrong assumptions, or myths about this whole notion about how we assess learning, you know, that I think it's we need to open this up to a much wider discussion, much wider debate. And so therefore you have to ask yourself, well, you know, where do we get to this point? How do we get to this point? And I think, and I'm interested in your comment, I think it came because of the communications vacuum. You know, I just think that in schools we took for granted that what we were doing, and I'll go back into the 90s, let's go back into the 90s or thereabouts or even earlier. You know, we thought the 10 to 15 minute or 5 to 10 minute discussion with parents once or twice a year and a report card with a number or a letter on it was adequate. And that was sort of the beginning and the end of it. And I think we left the door wide open for someone to come in and say, no, this is not adequate. We're not met. There's not enough accountability here. So then we had cross purposes because, as you said, people are trying to use standardized tests as a measure of learning and then somehow infer that as a measure on teacher performance.
Right.
And again, the absurdity of that is, you know, for people who work in this field, it's beyond reproach.
Yeah, and it makes no sense. And it puts incredible pressure on kids who are sitting down to take a test. I mean, imagine like a 12-year-old who sits down to take a test. And and kids aren't stupid. They know that their score on the test may affect their teacher's job status.
Yep.
I mean, that's insane to even think about doing that. And yet we don't even consider that. The harmful effects, just the anxiety that all this creates, the pressures, the narrowness that occurs when there's so much pressure on that test score, and the opportunities that we miss in school because nobody talks about that stuff very much, at least. And you know, I totally agree with kind of the history behind it. I also, however, think that there are lots of people who saw lots of opportunities to make lots of money.
Really?
You know, yeah.
Really?
Shocking, I know. Oh, no. Absolutely.
Wow.
And so they just did a really good marketing job and a really good lobbying job. And at least here in the States, got, you know, state houses and state legislatures to enact these tests and then to sell them for millions of dollars and to do the data work for millions of dollars, you know? So I know nobody's shocked by that fact, but it's something that you have to really step back from it and say, is this the best driver for the assessments that we give our kids? I mean, are these healthy and are they responsible? And I think it's hard to really make a case for that any longer.
And I think it's good that we are, you know, and I think other people now are starting to really call this out, that the motivation behind this is financial. I mean, you can't have a massive amount of evidence on one side, which says not only don't we have evidence that this is doing good, but we actually have very significant evidence that it's doing a lot of harm.
Yep.
It's harming kids. It's actually harming teaching practice. There's not even a shadow of a doubt that it's harming practice. And probably the thing that scared me the most is the time frame in which this has all turned around. It's happened in the space of about 5 years and then being reinforced for the following 5 to 10 years. And so it's become lobbyists versus learners. And I think the lobbyists are winning hands down at the moment. And, you know, as you said, it's the three T's. It's the textbook publishers, it's the tutoring companies, and it's the testing companies. When I think the figures, one of the statistics we quoted in the article was that the testing industry alone in the US alone, in 1 year alone, is worth $1.4 billion.
It's crazy. Yeah. It's
add that
crazy
up globally. Add that up across tutoring and textbooks. This is a big industry.
But, you know, there's another T too, and that's the technology companies. I mean,
How could I forget? You know, how could I possibly forget?
You know, we go to ISTE, although I'm not sure I'm going to ISTE next year. I don't think I am. But, you know, last time when we were at ISTE in San Antonio, we were walking the vendor floor and there was nothing but technology companies selling data and selling, you know, all sorts of test breakdowns and test prep and test this and test that. I mean, it's insidious and it's a shame that, well, but I guess it's capitalism.
That's right.
Drives it. And money drives it. And we've really lost, I think, and there are a lot of people now who are kind of waking up to that idea too, that we've really lost a good part of our soul in a lot of ways because of the extent to which capitalism has taken hold.
People, and I'm sure some people listening, some people watching on Facebook may well say to them, oh, come on, boys, you're going to an extreme. We're not. I think that's the point, everyone. I mean, in Change School, we have, you know, there's been agreement with our discussions there. You and I are working with schools around the world. You've just been over to Europe. You know, this is a conversation that's being held across every school across the globe. And yet it hasn't become public. It has the momentum for a call for change hasn't become strong enough yet, but I think it is growing very significantly. And the point you made around technology probably is the absolute highlight of what we're saying, because here we were moving to an environment where we were trying to provide ubiquitous access to technology through one-to-one initiatives and whatever, and they were going along, you know, quite well, growing. And then all of a sudden someone said online testing. Right. And out of the blue, the rationale for kids to have access to their own computer so they could be tested online. Goodness gracious me. You know, the tragedy of that is beyond the pale. Totally. So I think you're right. I think it's something now that I think people are the conversation's becoming a lot more public, and I think we have to take it. We had to build advocacy for a change.
I think, you know, there's actually an even more meta conversation around this too, right? Yep. And that is around not just testing, but grades in general. I actually came across a short little video clip from Alfie Cohn, who, you know, if you follow this conversation at all, you know that Alfie Cohn is one of the most outspoken people against testing grades and all that type of stuff. And it was actually a clip from our friend Gary Steger's Constructing Modern Knowledge conference back in 2008. And by the way, the good news is that Gary and Sylvie are putting on that conference again.
Yeah, fantastic.
So if you haven't been to Constructing Modern Knowledge, you definitely take a look you know, think hard about trying to make it up to Manchester. But, you know, Alfie Cohn says in this video, he says, look, when we start adding grades into the equation, when we start trying to motivate kids externally like that, that all the research shows that one of three things happen, or a combination of three things happen. And he said that number one, kids then try to take the easiest path, because there's risk in taking the complex path, right? If you take the hard path and you're really trying to do something that maybe you're not so sure of, you risk getting the A. You might get a C. It might be better work, but you don't want to do that. So you don't want to get that grade. So kids automatically, they're not stupid. They'll say, well, what's the easiest path that I can take to get that particular grade, right? Second thing is that they become less interested in the learning, because there's not an internal motivation to learn. It's not intrinsic. And so it becomes less meaningful for them. And the third part of it is that and again, this is all research-based, it says that kids learn it very superficially. And this is the reality in schools. Yep. That this is, again, one of those elephants in the room that we don't want to talk about very much. But no one argues very hard when you or me or anyone else says something like, kids forget most of what they learn in school. And we know that because we forgot most of what we learned in school.
Yep.
And it is because we're just trying to play the game.
Yep.
We're just trying to get through, and grades are the game.
Yep.
That's it.
Yep.
It's not learning. It's how do I get that particular GPA? How do I become valedictorian? How do I do well on the SAT, ACTs? And that goes to the whole tutoring thing. So, you know, to me, it's just this hugely dysfunctional way of thinking about evaluating learning. In every respect, whether it's a standardized test that everyone takes, or whether it's a local test in a classroom that basically individual teachers give to their kids, if the outcome is to simply get that grade or that GPA, we're not thinking about this in a very smart way.
Yeah, and I think
we know it, right? Because it's common sense, and we've all experienced it. Yet we're loath to even engage in that conversation. It's always interesting to me.
And it is interesting when you do reflect and you realize that the momentum for continuing and expanding this comes from outside the education sector. all of a sudden it does start to make sense, because you can't, you're looking at yourself and you're saying, how can I be having all these conversations when everyone inside here, you know, agrees with the direction we're taking, you know, these ideas, and in varying levels. We're not saying that everybody's, you know, singing from exactly the same choir book, but everyone certainly knows the harm that's being done here. They know that it can be done better. And we often quote, you know, Russell Ackoff's, you know, efficiency and effectiveness. It is both inefficient and ineffective. Mm-hmm. It is absurd. Mm-hmm. It's the only word for it. And I think, therefore, that, you know, as Tony Wagner said, it's not what you know that matters now. It's what you do with what you know. And that has to be the focus.
And that's the, so the assessments that we give in school don't happen in the real world. They simply don't exist in the real world.
No, not at
the
all.
The assessments in the real world are based on, well, did you solve the problem? You come up with a, you know, did you come up with an idea that works? Are you able to work with people, you know, in order to create something, to innovate, all those types of things?
And
I mean, and so the idea that we should be evaluating kids based on their ability to do real world work and the outcomes of that work isn't, again, it's not earth shattering. It's common sense. Yet. We just can't do that because, because there goes my phone all over the place. It's too messy. It's too difficult to do that. And yet everybody knows, again, that that's what we probably should be doing. The good news is that there are some shifts in that now. I mean, we've talked about the Mastery Consortium, mastery.org. Yes.
Absolutely.
Just to mention that again, and I spoke with someone actually last week who is a member, an independent school member of that group, and you know, these are the guys who are trying to get together and get rid of numbered transcripts in high school, so that it's not about basically your average or your score, but it's more about actually what you can do. I was a little bit disappointed to learn that I thought the time frame was 2 or 3 years, but really I think from what I heard last week, the time frame is more like 5 to 7 years. It's going to be a long-term process. But then when you think about it, that's a huge, huge boulder to roll up that hill, you know, so it is going to take time for them to do that. But I think it's interesting, again, that here's a group of people from the most prestigious independent schools in the country who are saying enough. This just isn't working. It's stupid. It doesn't make any sense. It's not based in research. We can do better.
Yeah.
We can do a better job for kids. What a concept that would be the motivator, you know, that would be what motivates us to change our practice.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when we talked about High Tech High, we've talked about lots of different places now where they're moving more toward exhibitions. And so, and I know you wrote about some of those too in that blog post, but I just think we are kind of at a turning point. I don't know if we're at a tipping point, but maybe we're at a turning point where at least people are looking at it now and going, if we don't start making our understanding of student learning more relevant to the way the world looks now, we're going to be, you know, literally putting our kids behind all sorts of eight balls, to use that, you know, expression, and not be able to thrive in the ways that they need to be able to thrive. They need to do all that work, you know, that self-assessment work and assess with others, just like we do in the real world.
Yeah, I think you make some good points there. And I think that the point is the issue really is that and we do this as almost as a cliche, that the public debate around education for too long hasn't been led by educators. It's, you know, we've mentioned the lobbyists leading the debate around testing. It's been read by journalists or politicians. I know in your country you've got, you know, interesting circumstances with your current Secretary for Education. But then I'd point to people like the Washington
Post. It's a kind word, but anyway,
I was just trying to be gentle.
Yes, thank you.
In many ways it's our own fault. As educators, we've got to step up to the plate. We've got to be more public in our opinions. We've been for too long, and I must say this is in this country, for too long a lot of the debate around the teachers were leading was too much around industrial conditions, you know, and around issues that the public couldn't relate to. We've got to focus it on learning. We've got to focus it on, you know, what we're doing in schools. We've got to be more open and transparent about our practice. And we've got to be more willing to break through that communications vacuum that we've had in the past and allow parents to be very aware of the sorts of alternatives that we're talking about that are much better for their sons or daughters. Just a quick back pass on the point you made about the real world, as we get told. The real world doesn't function to high stakes testing. I won't name the company because it's not appropriate given what I'm going to say, but one of the very large, we'll just call them one of the very top five biggest technology companies in the world that I spent, you know, 20 or 30 years working with very closely at a very senior level. You know, that was a company that essentially I watched it on a day-to-day basis, and its success was built around the times that where they collaborated. But they had a huge problem in this company, and I'm sure most of you can work out which one I'm talking about, because the employees in the company were ranked. There was a ranking of the and guess what became the obsession in the company? And I'd see it every January because that was when ranking came up for review.
That's right.
And it was on the edge of destroying the company. And just to make it even more specific, in the last two or three years, there's been a radical change in that company. And this focus or this, you know, obsession with ranking has been taken away. And all of a sudden, the company's become more collaborative, more open. And there's a whole change in the culture within the company. Now, that's just one company. It's a very prominent company, but it's firsthand experience. But I've worked, you know, with many other companies, who I can mention, you know, Intel and others, who, you know, inside these companies on a day-to-day basis, someone doesn't, you know, throw a test at them and said, I'll give you an hour. You can't look at anything. You can't look at a book. You can't look at a computer. You know, how much do you remember on this topic? I mean, it is just so unreal. It's got nothing to do with the real world. It's an unreal world that we're imposing on kids with standardized testing, and it's about time it came to an end. So as you said, I agree with you. It's a good way of putting it. We're at a turning point, probably not a tipping point yet. And I think that you mentioned Elfie Kahn. I think we also both referred to Deb Meyer's new book that she wrote with Matthew Canister. And yep. For those people who are watching the Facebook, I just put it up on the screen, which is exceptional. And we both know that both Deb and Elfie, of course, have been advocates for this for many, many years together with Gary and others. But her latest book, Beyond Testing, Seven Assessments of Student Schools and Seven More Effective Than Standardized Testing, you know, I think is an exceptionally good example of the alternatives we should be considering.
As long as we are comfortable with the messiness of these, right? Because that is, you know,
they're not
but
messy,
that is,
are they? They're not
that is the big difference.
Yeah.
In that, you know, I mean, it's just that again, just getting back to the idea that one of the reasons we get tests again is just because they're very easy. They're just simple, and we can collect a lot of very concrete data on kids. But we all know that there are better ways to do it. And you've read Deb's book, and I'm working my way through it. But just really briefly, I thought it'd be interesting just to talk about these seven and give them maybe a couple minutes each, to give some sense or some reflection on how effective we've seen them, because I think we've seen all of these in our travels. You know, you've been doing this now for about 80 years, and I've been 85 years. I've been doing it for, you know, about a dozen years now. But so, you know, student self-assessments, that's number one, right? And so
good place to start, by the way.
Yeah, it's a great place to start because, you know, you and I in our work are together, and in our work as individuals are constantly self-assessing.
Mm-hmm.
We try to get as much feedback as we can from the participants in our communities, and you know, I try to get feedback from the people who invite me to come in and speak. But more than anyone else, I'm the one who's assessing how well I do, and I didn't learn how to do that in school. I learned how to do that when I went out on my own. By the way. You know, when I was a teacher, I did some self-assessment, but I was still getting that evaluation at the end of the year that said, this is what you're good at, this is what you're not good at, here are your goals.
Yep, yep.
There is no, I don't get that at all anymore. And so I'm the one that has to do that. I mean, what is the difficulty with teaching kids or helping kids learn how to self-assess the work that they do in schools? It shouldn't be that hard.
And I think that You know, if we a big focus I know that all of us are talking about within the modern learning environment is this notion of self-managing, self-directing your learning. Well, how can you direct your own learning if you're not able to assess the effectiveness of what you know and what you can do with what you know? So, as I said, I think it's great that you listed as this sort of number one because it's fundamental to where we should be going.
That's a great point. You know, we talk about student-centered learning all the time. We never talk about student-centered assessment.
Correct. Yeah.
That's a great point. That's a great point. Second one she talks about is direct teacher observations of students and their work. What a concept.
I've never heard of that before. Is that a new idea? Is that something?
The teacher should be the expert, right? And be able to just observe what's happening and provide some feedback or some evaluation as to what the work looks like. I mean, what are we paying teachers for?
Yeah, but Will, that does require one thing, trust.
Mm, absolutely.
We have to trust teachers as professionals, as the learning professionals, to be able to do that. And if we don't, I don't know what the heck we've even got schools for and teachers. And I think that's the biggest... And the biggest subvertive influence of the testing is that, to me, it screams, we don't trust.
And it's not just that we don't trust, but I don't think the vast majority of educators, again, it goes back to this idea that they see themselves as teachers and they don't see themselves as learners.
Yep, very much.
If you're assessing learning, you have to be a learner. I mean, yep. I ask this question almost in jest, you know, everywhere I go, which not everywhere, but I'll say, you know, you are the learning experts in this community, right? And usually I get hit with dead silence. And then I'll go, hey, wait, whoa, you are, aren't you? And then they'll all go, oh, yeah, that's right, we are. But we don't treat educators like that. And you're right. We don't trust them to do the work that we know they can do. Teachers are eminently capable. Especially those who have expertise in their field and all teachers who care about kids, you know, they're eminently able to help kids or to evaluate kids' work. So, I mean, that should just be a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Descriptive reviews of the child.
Yeah. Well,
I haven't seen this done very often, but
no.
I know more and more schools now are moving toward narratives.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the schools that we worked with in Change School down in Houston went to a narrative form of evaluation and assessment, and the parents loved it. I mean,
yeah.
So there's a lot to be said for doing that as well.
Yeah, I think there was a good example. I also saw Will, a school out in Eltham here in Melbourne. And it was a simple thing. It was a very simple thing. It was done to very early grades. It was done with 5 and 6 year old kids. And the commentary around a child was done on a weekly basis. There was literally every week there was a commentary that would go home to all parents, but it would talk about the children. Now, it required, as you said, one, it was messy. Two, it required a little bit more work than is normally possible. But from it meant that parents were continually informed about the progress. They didn't write a narrative around every child every week. I'm not saying that. It was actually done in a really good way. It was like a one-pager each week. Right. And it was essentially a newsletter, but it wasn't done as a newsletter. It was done a commentary. Basically, it was a learning commentary. And I thought if I'd received that, you know, 30 times in a year or whatever it is, you know, I don't need a number. I don't need a letter.
No.
You've told me where my child is.
That's the only feedback I got on my kid's education was in the parent portal, and it was just, you know, silliness. I had no idea what that number meant.
I thought portal solved the problem.
Nah, portal didn't solve
it. They didn't. No. Oh,
Deb's,
that's a shock.
Let's move on. Deb's next one was reading and math interviews with children. And, I mean, and you know, again, one, you can talk to that one probably better than I, because I'm sure that's something that you probably did when you were a school principal and you know, those types of interventions or those types of interviews, I think are pretty powerful.
Yeah. And I think that it's sad that people think there's some sort of narrow, you know, high stakes way of evaluating a child's ability to read. Well, it's such an anathema. It's such a contrast to what you need to be able to do when you're trying to assess a child's understanding of the concept of reading, particularly at a very early age. You know, you want to, as Deb talks about, you want to be able to go beyond, can you bark out words off a page? You know, barking out words off a page or, you know, a very trivial understanding of mathematics such as recalling a simple fact, is not about an understanding. You know, mathematics, I always think of, you know, and it wasn't just Papert, it's others who talk about being, mathematics isn't about being able to recall number facts. It's about thinking mathematically.
That's right.
And you can't get an A for thinking, oh, I got a C for thinking mathematically really not that well or whatever it is. You know, to be able to assess whether a child can think mathematically, you've got to talk with them about mathematics. You've got to talk with them about their understanding. And I've seen some exceptional examples. I remember, I'll name it, Tom Seidenberg up at school up in New Hampshire was taking a maths lesson for 16-year-old kids. And boy, oh boy, at the end of that lesson, you could have written 5 pages of summary notes about the kids' understanding of mathematics. It was just spectacular.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a great one that she highlighted there. The fifth one she mentions, of course, is there's more and more awareness of this, particularly with technology assisting, and that's the use of portfolios and the public defense of student work.
And so, you know, I was doing that when I was teaching back in the 90s, way back when. And
yep.
But, you know, the thing that I think was, that I thought was interesting and most powerful about our use of portfolios was the ability to get kids to reflect deeply on their work by looking at their full body of work.
Yes.
And commenting and again, kind of thinking about where they came from, what they learned, what they didn't learn, where they struggled, where their strengths were. You know, and especially as a writing teacher, I just found it loathsome to grade student writing. I just found it very difficult. But what I thought was much more effective was to try to give some co-assessment with kids on their effort and how hard they worked. And portfolios just were such an awesome tool for that. And then to defend it. So the idea was, you know, when in my classrooms, kids had to find specific examples of early work as compared to later work to show some evolution in the thinking or in the ability or whatever. And I think kids learned a great deal from going through that process, and they gave themselves a grade.
Yeah.
Which then, you know, I tried to, and most times kids were really hard on themselves, you know. Most kids gave themselves a lower grade than I would have. And so we kind of negotiated that out. But I think portfolios are, again, they're powerful, but they're messy and they take a little bit more work. And, you know, the next one too that she mentions, the number 6, you know, about school reviews and observations by professionals, that's messier, it takes more time. But I mean, that's what that's how we learn in the real world, you know, when other people comment on our work, when we get feedback from people who know more than we do, when someone else is able to use our work or not. And I think that's just a one that I don't see very much of in schools at all.
No. And then finally, she mentioned school boards and town meetings, which are self-explanatory and some people are obviously familiar with. The one that I also wanted to throw across it, and she mentions it in various forms, but I think it's worth highlighting, is this notion about peer assessment. This notion about students assessing students. And again, it goes back to the comment you made when you were working with students with their writing. And that is that, you know, again, it's about trust, but it's also about helping kids develop that skill of critique. And and I'm reminded of, you know, a colleague, Esme Kapp at Princes Hill. And she said to me, you know, with some of her staff that, you know, one of the key skills that they look to develop in their students, and by the way, I'm talking at this stage about students of sort of 6 and 7 years of age,
right,
is their ability to critique other students' work.
Right.
You know, how do you make commentary on a colleague's work at 6 and 7 years of age in a way that's constructive, that's direct, that doesn't just pat someone on the back for the sake of it? And if you can do that when you're 6 or 7 years of age, boy, you're setting yourself in a great place for the rest of your life.
But we take that agency over assessment away from them early on in schools. You know, and we inculcate them very quickly to the idea that you have to please the teacher. And you know, I'm not saying that we do that nefariously, and I'm not saying that we do it with any ill intent, but it's just the way that we do it. It's just the way that the system works. It's just the way that the external pressures require us to do it. And it's at the end of the day, I think one of the most frustrating things about the entire school experience is how little it really makes sense. And we'll kind of wrap it up here since we've been going for about 40 minutes or so. But I you know, I found that we mentioned Gary earlier, and we talk about Gary a lot as someone who is constantly pushing our thinking. And I found a great quote from Gary that in an article that he wrote a few years ago, where he was talking about assessment. And here's the quote. I just think it's really interesting. He says, students will want to do the best job possible when they care about their work and know that you put them ahead of a grade. If students are collaborating and regularly engaged in peer review or editing, then the judgment of an adult is really unnecessary. Worst of all, it's coercive and often punitive.
Yeah, well, in typical fashion, he said it beautifully.
And I think he's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. There are so many times when we don't really need to assess, when we shouldn't be assessing everything, when we shouldn't, you know, when it should be more about collaborative feedback, where it should be more about modeling and just, you know, like Deb Meyer was talking about, interviews and conversations and helping kids develop the skills that they need to assess one another, assess themselves, like you just said. I mean, when we get in the way of that, we change the whole dynamic of learning. When we're the ones who are setting the expectations and evaluating them with rubrics or grades or whatever else, it changes the whole dynamic of the of the exercise. And it's just sad on a lot of levels, the extent to which we program kids to do the work, you know, play the game and to just work to get the assessment, when it becomes more about grades and less about learning.
So let's hope that your comment earlier about this now being a turning point does move to being a tipping point, Will, and hopefully this podcast and what we're doing and all the work of the people in Change School and so many people around the world, Elfie and Deb and Matthew and others and Gary, I mean, everyone has, you know, has been working in this space for a while. I think now that the voices are getting louder, and hopefully we are going to take a more rational, common sense approach to the best way of doing this. And we go back to where we started inside all our work in Modern Learners. How about we start looking at the learning?
Yeah, absolutely. And so for those of you who may be watching this later or listening later, first of all, thanks again for spending some time with us. Really appreciate it. These are the types of conversations we're having in our new community, our changeleaders.community, which we hope you'll check out. We've got about 300 people in there already. And we're having some pretty high level conversations about not just assessment, but about everything to do with school and modern learning. And also, don't forget, if you really want to take a deep dive, our fourth cohort of Change School is going to open up in January, and you can go to change.school to get more information on that and to sign up to be notified when our registration opens for that. But at any rate, we really want to thank you for tuning in. And Bruce, as always, been a great conversation. Safe travels tomorrow to New Zealand, and we will hopefully catch up with one another again real soon.
Cheers, mate.